one whit, for, with the Negro, as with all races, mental strength is the basis of all progress. Kelly Miller saw the controversy over differences in educational philosophy to be the work of one-eyed enthusiasts rather than of men like Du Bois and Washington, who saw the need for both. Booker T. Washington saw his own primary task as the promotion of progress among the many and not the special culture of the few. He saw his work as an educator in his times as preparatory, as laying a foundation for the masses, but not to confine the whole race to the work for which Tuskegee Institute would immediately prepare its students. After speaking proudly of a Tuskegee graduate whose knowledge of chemistry had increased the acreage yield of sweet potatoes several fold, he said, "My theory of education for the Negro would not, for example, confine him for all time to farm work, to the production of the best and most sweet potatoes, but that, if he succeeded in this line of industry, he could lay the foundations upon which his children and grandchildren could grow to higher and more important things in life. Even in the present," he said, "we need professional men and women," and he looked forward to a time when there would be more successful black lawyers, congressmen, and music teachers. As regards civil rights, although Booker T. Washington wrote in 1899, "I do not favor the Negro's giving up anything which is fundamental and which has been guaranteed to him by the Constitution of the United States," his general public posture was that he was too busy with the self-improvement of blacks to become involved in political controversies. Yet, when his papers were examined after his death, it became clear that he had privately goaded other blacks to crusade for civil rights and had even secretly financed legal challenges to the Jim Crow laws in the South. Washington was fully aware that to have done these things publicly would have jeopardized the white financial support on which Tuskegee Institute depended. Nor was this simply a matter of protecting his own interests. He understood the repercussions for others if he made explosive statements in the volatile racial atmosphere of the times. "I could stir up a race war in Alabama in 6 weeks if I chose," he said, "but to do so would wipe out the achievements of decades of labor." Yet he also understood that open challenges to racial discrimination had to be made. As he wrote to Oswald Garrison Villard, one of the founders of the NAACP, "There is work to be done which no one placed in my position can do." Although Du Bois could not have known of all the things that Washington was doing secretly, he had an insight into the man himself and knew where his loyalties were. Du Bois said of Washington, "He had no faith in white people, not the slightest." Booker T. Washington practiced what a later generation of black militants would only preach, to advance the cause of blacks by all means necessary. A leading black educator of his time, Dean Kelly Miller of Howard University, said of Washington that the advancement of the black race is the chief burden of his soul. Despite differences between Du Bois and Washington and rivalries between their respective followers, this did not prevent civility between the two men themselves. In Booker T. Washington's autobiography, Up From Slavery, he wrote of a meeting arranged by some good ladies in Boston in 1899, where, in addition to an address by myself, Mr. Paul Lawrence Dunbar read from his poems, and Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois read an original sketch. In 1903, Du Bois wrote a critical essay about Washington that has since been widely quoted. What has not been so widely known is that Du Bois's aunt chided him for that essay, explaining how his role and constraints were very different from those of Booker T. Washington, and expressing her hope that he would never write about the Tuskegee educator that way again. Decades later, recalling this conversation, Du Bois added, "And I never did." Black colleges. Although most black colleges began as institutions run by white administrators and staffed by white professors, pressures to change that began in the 19th century. There were at that point relatively few blacks with the education needed to take on these roles, but there were even fewer opportunities for such people to find employment elsewhere. Moreover, there was a concern for the effect on the black students of being educated by whites. As one of the more militant black leaders said in 1885, "The intellects of our young people are being educated at the expense of their manhood, because in their classrooms they see only white professors, thereby reinforcing the superiority-inferiority stereotypes." Others, however, caution that our youth have the right to the best possible training, and we should not allow a mistaken race pride to cause us to impose upon them inferior teachers. Significantly, the parents of these students usually preferred the skills of white teachers to the symbolism of black representation. The pool of qualified black scholars was small. Prior to the First World War, only 14 black Americans had ever received a PhD from a recognized American or European university. Nevertheless, with the passing years, the political pressures eventually won out, and colleges for black students began to be staffed increasingly by black professors and run by black administrators. Whether or not these professors and administrators had sufficient training or ability. In 1926, half a century after its founding, Howard University had its first black president. A leading black scholar of a later era, E. Franklin Frazier, wrote of this transition period as an educational setback, and Dean Kelly Miller, who lived through that era at Howard University, called it a misfortune barely short of a calamity. This was not just a misfortune for that era. Putting underqualified people in charge of black colleges and universities meant that the whole development of these institutions would be shaped or warped by department chairmen, deans, and college presidents whose priorities, including holding on to their jobs, made better qualified blacks who would emerge over time be seen as rivals to be repressed rather than assets to be treasured, and the latter's more intellectual orientation as nothing to be encouraged. The first black president of Howard University, Mordecai W. Johnson, has been cited as a major obstacle to the research of internationally renowned black scientist Ernest Just, whose research grants from prestigious outside institutions were interfered with by Johnson. As late as 1971, decades after the transition to black academic leadership, a study of black colleges concluded, "The administration is usually not interested in scholarly performance, though this kind of activity is tolerated, and the spoon-feeding method of teaching certainly does not call for it." The result was that with a relative handful of exceptions among black institutions, the writing pens of members of these institutions have been virtually silent. The years in office of administrators at black colleges and universities tended to be some multiple of that of administrators in white institutions, given the black administrators' lack of viable alternatives in the larger society. Mordecai Johnson, for example, remained president of Howard University for 34 years. The net result was that the influence of the initial generation of underqualified people lasted longer and shaped the enduring values and priorities that prevailed on black campuses. These values and priorities, in turn, shaped the kinds of people who would be groomed and selected to become their successors, perpetuating low academic standards, frivolous social activities among students, and indifference, incompetence, and corruption among the administration and faculty. The transition from white to black leadership in black colleges was much more than a racial change. It was a major cultural change from a missionary generation of academic leaders bent on supplanting the existing black redneck culture with a transplanted culture representing very different values, to new leaders more accommodating to the black redneck culture in all its aspects, from academic laxity to sexual laxity, showiness, and corruption. In the words of E. Franklin Frazier, "The entire orientation and aim of higher education of Negroes was changing." Among these changes was that traditional standards of morals and manners gave way among both students and their teachers. Students became far less interested in academic study than in such things as fraternities, sororities, and parties. Partly, this reflected a changing mix of students, as colleges, black and white, drew on a broader social range after the Second World War, partly as a result of the availability of financial support from the GI Bill. Writing in the middle of the 20th century, Frazier said, "The average Negro who enters the Negro college has had little contact with books and has not developed reading habits. Moreover, when he enters college, he does not find an atmosphere where educational values and scholarship are highly respected." Frazier described the new black college students as listless and less concerned with the history or understanding of the world around them than with their appearance at the next social affair. Moreover, such concerns were supported by the new generation of administrators. The girl with a peasant or working class background may be irritated by her mother's inability to buy an expensive party dress. But what can be expected when the Dean of Women has instructed her to tell her mother that she must have the dress at any sacrifice? As for the faculty, Professor Fraser described them this way in the middle of the 20th century. Unlike the missionary teachers, the present teachers have little interest in making men, but are concerned primarily with teaching as a source of income, which will enable them to maintain middle-class standards and participate in Negro society. It appears that the majority of them have no knowledge of books nor any real love of literature. Today, many of the teachers of English and literature never read a book as a source of pleasure or recreation. In short, the black colleges retrogress toward the black redneck culture. The stultifying and anti-intellectual atmosphere on many black college campuses has been described with painful frankness in Professor Fraser's 1958 book, Black Bourgeoisie, by black novelist Ralph Ellison in Invisible Man, and by white scholars Christopher Jenks and David Reisman in a comprehensive 1967 article in the Harvard Educational Review, which may well have been the last honest study of black colleges, given the rising racial militancy and the automatic labeling of white critics as racists. There have been no black college equivalents of Dunbar High School or other high-achieving black elementary and secondary schools. One major historic difference between black colleges and Dunbar High School was the highly qualified, if not overqualified, early leadership of Dunbar and the underqualified first generation of black leadership of the black colleges, the latter put in place for purposes of symbolic racial representation. There were enduring consequences to the different calibers of people who shaped these different institutions in their formative stages and set in motion values and priorities which shaped and selected their successors in the generations ahead. In a much later era, beginning in the 1960s, a similar setting up of black studies departments at predominantly white colleges across the country, with little or no regard to the wholly inadequate numbers of academically qualified people to staff so many departments established simultaneously, likewise put in place a first generation of black academics who would lead such departments in non-academic or even anti-intellectual directions. Even though there was no inherent reason why the scholarly study of the history, economics, politics, or sociology of black Americans could not be a serious enterprise, in practice, black studies programs, by and large, became noted for shoddy standards for both students and faculty. It is doubtful whether so many academic departments could be set up simultaneously in any academic field without exhausting the pool of qualified faculty members, but no one attempted such a thing in traditional academic departments. As with many of the black colleges, the inadequacies of the black pioneers and black studies warped the future, even after those pioneers passed from the scene and better qualified people became available. By the same token, the kinds of highly qualified people who shaped the future Dunbar High School in its formative years left an enduring legacy of high standards and performances. White colleges. Although black students were admitted to some white colleges, notably Oberlin, Bowdoin, Hillsdale, and Western Reserve, even before the Civil War, most postbellum black students pursued their higher education at the black colleges until the 1960s. In the decades that followed, up to the present, the majority of black students have attended predominantly white colleges. Given the scarcity of black students with the educational background and academic achievements common among other students at the predominantly white colleges, these institutions' desires to secure a demographically representative student body made lower standards of admissions for blacks virtually inevitable. This problem was not confined to colleges with very high academic standards. When top-tier colleges and universities accepted black students who met the normal qualifications for second-tier institutions, similar pressures led second-tier institutions to accept black students who would normally qualify for third-tier colleges and universities, and so on down the line. With black students systematically mismatched with academic institutions across the spectrum, it can hardly be surprising that most black students nationwide failed to graduate. Such negative educational results repeated a pattern of bad educational results from making educational decisions on non-educational grounds that began with the creation of black colleges that were colleges in name only in the 19th century, for the sake of denominational rivalry, and later putting underqualified people in charge of these black colleges for the sake of racial representation. Very similar corrupting and anti-intellectual consequences have followed latter-day educational policies based on demographic representation. Moreover, these consequences have endured, even through turnovers of students and faculty over the years. The admission of black students with qualifications markedly lower than those of the other students at the same institutions was soon followed by hiring black faculty members with qualifications likewise lower than those of their white and Asian faculty colleagues. This was done for the same reason, namely, that there were simply not enough blacks with the usual academic qualifications to achieve demographic representation any other way. Not only are there far fewer black students than Asian American students who reach the usual test score levels found at selective colleges, this shortfall is even more drastic at the postgraduate level, where future faculty members are produced. In some years, the absolute numbers of blacks receiving PhDs in mathematics did not reach double digits. Summary and implications. Education has played a crucial role in the advancement of blacks over the generations, and in the lags of blacks behind others in the American economy. In order to understand both the lags and the advancement, it is necessary to understand the extremely low level from which the education of most black Americans began, and the very long time before the great majority of blacks had the kind of education that would qualify them for many of the occupations in which education was essential. Racial discrimination barriers kept educated blacks out of some of these occupations, but until perhaps the middle of the 20th century, there were relatively few blacks to be kept out by such barriers. Looked at differently, the dramatic increases in the numbers of blacks in many professional occupations in the last half of the 20th century cannot be attributed solely, or even primarily, to the removal of these barriers by civil rights legislation. The rise of blacks into professional and other high-level occupations was greater in the years preceding passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 than in the years following passage of that act. What had happened was a dramatic increase in the numbers of blacks with college and postgraduate education. Prior to the First World War, fewer than 5,000 college degrees had been granted to black students in the entire history of the United States. But by 1935, that had increased fivefold, and by 1947, the black colleges alone granted in 1 year more degrees than blacks had ever received in all the years prior to the First World War. Increases in the numbers of doctorates received by blacks were also dramatic. Similarly, despite a widespread tendency to see the rise of blacks out of poverty as due to the civil rights movement and government social programs of the 1960s, in reality, the rise of blacks out of poverty was greater in the two decades preceding 1960 than in the decades that followed. Education was a major factor in this as well. As of 1940, non-white males averaged just 5.4 years of schooling, compared to 8.7 for white males. Over the next two decades, the absolute amount of education increased for both, and the gap between them narrowed. In 1940, the difference in schooling between black and white young adult males, aged 25 to 29, was 4 years. But by 1960, that had shrunk to less than 2 years. Because this was an era of massive black migration out of the South, this quantitative narrowing of the gap in schooling may well have been accompanied by a qualitative improvement, as many blacks left behind the low-quality schools in the Jim Crow South. How did this translate into economic change? As of 1940, more than four-fifths of black families, 87% in fact, lived below the official poverty level. By 1960, this had fallen to 47%. In other words, the poverty rate among blacks had been nearly cut in half before either the Civil Rights Revolution or the Great Society social programs began in the 1960s. The continuation of this trend can hardly be automatically credited to these political developments, though such claims are often made, usually ignoring the pre-existing trends whose momentum could hardly have been expected to stop in the absence of such legislation. By 1970, the poverty rate among blacks had fallen to 30%, a welcome development, but by no means unprecedented. A decade after that, with the rise of affirmative action in the intervening years, the poverty rate among black families had fallen to 29%. Even if one attributes all of this 1% decline to government policy, it does not compare to the dramatic declines in poverty among blacks when the only major change was the rise in their education. Whatever the merits of various movements and programs on other grounds, the claim that they were the primary factor in the economic advancement of blacks cannot be squared with the facts. Yet a whole generation of black leaders, intellectuals, and activists have become committed to such movements and programs and their accompanying rhetoric. However, Frederick Douglass warned, as far back as the 1870s, that blacks should cultivate their brains more and their lungs less. While no one can deny the existence of racial discrimination in employment, housing, and other areas, the assumption that the magnitude of employment discrimination can be measured by relative numbers of blacks in particular occupations ignores the huge quantitative and qualitative differences in education between blacks and whites which existed in past generations, often as a result of government discrimination in the provision of educational resources. Without an understanding of the reasons for both the lags and the progress of blacks in the past, policy prescriptions for future advancement risk misplaced emphases. More specifically, it risks underestimating the importance of the quantity and quality of education, which depends upon both students and teachers, and much less on the amount of money fed into education bureaucracies or on the fads and panaceas that come and go in the schools and colleges. While the New England culture that was transplanted into various Southern enclaves after the Civil War had remarkable successes, later successful black schools a century later usually had no New England origins, but, like New England, they represented a culture very unlike the black redneck culture. Ralph Ellison has pointed out that such stellar black singers as Paul Robeson and Marian Anderson received their development from an extensive personal contact with European culture, free from the influences which shape Southern Negro personality in the United States. For those who are interested in schools that produce academic success for minority students, there is no lack of examples, past and present. Tragically, there has been an utter lack of interest in academically successful black schools by most educators. Among the few who have even bothered to take notice, too many have been as dogmatic as Kenneth B. Clark, who said that excellence at Dunbar represented the few, that Dunbar is the only example in our history of a separate black school that was able, somehow, to be equal, a result of unique circumstances that could scarcely have existed in any other part of the country. Every one of these unsubstantiated claims was demonstrably untrue. 1/3 of all the black high school students in Washington were not the few. There were and are other black schools that met or exceeded national norms, as examples discussed here have shown, and far from being confined to Washington, they have been found from New England to California. Why this ignoring or dismissal of examples of black educational success? Sometimes the reason is ideological. Some, like Professor Clark, have a vested interest in the doctrine that separate is inferior, which underpinned the historic Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court decision, in which his research was cited. To say that mixing and matching racial groups is not a prerequisite for quality education would call into question the decades-long school busing struggle, which might then be seen in retrospect as a costly and divisive wild goose chase, and questions might be raised about the current mantra of diversity. Other reasons for ignoring or downplaying successful black schools include the fact that there is no political mileage or financial benefits to be gotten from focusing on such schools, despite how much of an educational goldmine their experience might be for black children. Put bluntly, failure attracts more money than success. Politically, failure becomes a reason to demand more money, smaller classes, and more trendy courses and programs, ranging from black English to bilingualism and self-esteem. Politicians who want to look compassionate and concerned know that voting money for such projects accomplishes that purpose for them, and voting against such programs risks charges of mean-spiritedness, if not implications of racism. Ironically, many of the bitter-end defenders of the current public school system and its educational dogmas are also in favor of preferential admissions of minority students to colleges and universities. In other words, having denied minority children an opportunity to develop the kinds of intellectual skills that would make lower admission standards for them unnecessary, they then send minority students on to institutions where they are less likely to meet course standards designed for better-prepared students, and where most minority students do not last long enough to graduate. During their time on campus, such students help present a photogenic picture of diversity on many campuses, but their roles are much like those of movie extras, who simply provide a background for others. Despite many pious expressions of goodwill and hope for improvements in the education of minority students, few are prepared to do what it takes, including taking on entrenched vested interests in the schools of education, the teachers' unions, and state, local, and national educational bureaucracies. Even fewer are prepared to challenge black students to work harder and abandon the counterproductive notion that seeking educational excellence is acting white. Despite the heartening achievements of some black schools, which have repeatedly demonstrated what is possible even with children from low-income backgrounds, the general picture of the education of black students is bleak. Much of what is said, and not said, about the education of black students reflects the political context rather than the educational facts. Whites walk on eggshells for fear of being called racists, while many blacks are preoccupied with protecting the image of black students, rather than protecting their future by telling the blunt truth. It is understandable that some people are concerned about image, about what in private life might be expressed as, "What will the neighbors think?" But when your children are dying, you don't worry about what the neighbors think. History versus visions. It requires courage to cast the accumulated myths of a lifetime to the wind. Our national desire for simplicity, certitude, and the approval of others occasionally causes us to defend even our most flawed worldviews as if our very lives depended on them. Dead belief systems are difficult to bury, for in doing so we enter a world we do not recognize. We watch the carefully crafted towers of our understanding crash down in ruins, and we lose an integral piece of the only reality we have known, reinforced and imprinted on our minds by a thousand voices, internal and external. John Perazzo. Nowhere has history been more enthralled to belief systems, visions, than in the history of racial and ethnic groups. Too often the past has been twisted to fit the visions and the agendas of the present. Much of the history written about minority groups has in fact been a history of how others treated these groups, more so than a history of the groups themselves. This bias has distorted both the histories of racial and ethnic groups and the histories of the societies in which they have lived. Black Americans are just one of the groups whose history has been seen in this strange and twisted way as a commentary on American society, and an opportunity to score ideological points or promote guilt or gain some contemporary political advantage. Mention Japanese Americans, and internment camps come up. Mention Mexican Americans, and the things suffered by them or by Mexico are sure to become the focus of discussion. Injustices should not be swept under the rug, but whole peoples are more than the sum of the injustices they have suffered. At least they should be seen as more, if history is truly to be history and not just the projection into the past of contemporary visions and agendas. Where world history is concerned, the same skewed approach has too often prevailed. Few things attract less attention than the achievements of the West, which have improved the lives of peoples around the world through medical science, technology, and economic organizations more effective at producing the material output on which people depend for food, shelter, and the comforts and amenities of life. Those who warn against being Eurocentric are themselves often the most Eurocentric of all when it comes to assigning blame for slavery, imperialism, wars, and other human tragedies that have originated on every inhabited continent at one period of history or another. Multiculturalism has not meant warts and all portraits of different societies around the world. For many, it has meant virtually a warts-only portrait of the West, and a no-warts portrait of non-Western peoples. More is involved than a simple bias, however. The central doctrine of multiculturalism, the equality of cultures, cannot be sustained when that means equality of concrete achievements, educationally, economically, or otherwise. It is not only the West whose achievements must be brushed aside or glided over in silence. Particularly dangerous to contemporary visions and agendas are achievements by groups that began in poverty and rose to prosperity, such as emigrants from Japan, Italy, China, or India, who settled in various countries around the world. It is not just their achievements, but the very concept of achievement which is antithetical to the multicultural vision, and which is therefore often evaded or denied. Much verbal ingenuity has been used circumventing the concept of achievements by calling them advantages or privileges, even when this does violence to the meanings of words and the facts of history. Often, discussions of the supposedly impenetrable social barriers of poverty and skin color prejudice pass over in utter silence the history of various emigrants from Asia whose economic levels have in fact often begun in poverty and later surpassed that of the white majorities in countries of the Western Hemisphere. When visions and agendas suppress history, that not only distorts the achievements of groups, nations, or civilizations, it forfeits valuable knowledge as to the things that have led to past progress and can lead to progress for others who are still lagging today. In short, it sacrifices the material interests of millions for the ideological or other parochial interests of a few. History and causation. History offers not simply a chronicle of events, but, more importantly, opportunities to gain insights about the human condition from the experiences of other times and places. That is, it offers not merely facts, but explanations. When it comes to the history of different racial, ethnic, or other social groups, nothing calls more obviously for explanation than the great differences in rewards and performances among them. Here, causal explanations impinge on prevailing visions. Where the prevailing vision is one of external causation, verbal ingenuity often seeks to banish internal explanations. External versus internal explanations. One of the ways of sealing off a vision from the intrusion of discordant facts is with an ideological vocabulary that neutralizes such facts. One of the most important facts to be neutralized and excluded a priori from the prevailing vision of our times is the fact of differences in capabilities among individuals, groups, nations, and civilizations. When achievements are described as advantages or privileges, differences in outcomes ex post are treated as evidence or proof of differences in opportunities ex ante. What these verbal fashions accomplish in a wide range of circumstances is to preclude internal explanations of intergroup differences in favor of external explanations. Thus, the success of Lebanese businessmen in competing with their European counterparts in colonial Africa has been attributed to various Lebanese advantages. Firstly, the Lebanese had lower personal consumption levels than the Europeans. Besides, they had the advantage of having members of the family work in their shops and thus be an economic asset instead of a liability, as was the case with the Europeans. In a situation where Lebanese skill was at least as good as their rivals, they could win over a gradually increasing share of the businesses by price competition. In addition, the Lebanese skill was in some respects superior to that of the Europeans. The former had many more contacts with the African clients, were willing to talk and bargain with them at length, and therefore had closer knowledge of them. As a result, they could grant credit to the Africans with less risk than the Europeans, could have earlier indication of shifts in consumer demand or crop prospects, and could manage the repayment relationship more skillfully. Another advantage of the Lebanese, in the early days at least, was that little of his profit had to be diverted to the amortization of fixed capital, because there was little fixed capital. Thus, successful price competition by the Lebanese merchant was based on the advantages of both lower business and personal costs. Not one of these internal achievements of the Lebanese was due to any external benefits being made available to them that were not equally available to Europeans. On the contrary, the Lebanese typically began with less money than their European rivals, though even their little fixed capital is described as if it were an asset. But such a situation would not have been confined to the early days before the Lebanese achieved prosperity if, in fact, it were an asset. Here again, the vocabulary of the prevailing vision must neutralize or evade the plain fact that some people achieve better than others by describing the means of their achievements as advantages. If the very concept of achievement is a threat to the vision, then overcoming adversity is even more of a threat. Both must be verbally transformed into privileges and advantages in order to protect the vision. Conversely, the failure of particular people to achieve is often transformed verbally into a denial of access or opportunity to them by others. Those who do not meet the same standards for college admissions or mortgage loans as often as others do are said to be denied an opportunity for a higher education or access to loans to buy a home. Any adverse information on such groups must be verbally transformed into stereotypes or myths. There simply cannot be any facts contrary to the vision. This vision has become part of the law of the land, so that an American employer can be found guilty of discrimination without a speck of evidence of discrimination against any specific individual, if the demographic makeup of his workforce differs from what prevailing preconceptions say it would be in the absence of discrimination. The absurd limit to which this vocabulary can go is illustrated by scholarly, or at least academic, studies of Malaysia that describe the Malays as a deprived group there, and non-Malay minorities as having privilege, because the latter have had greater economic success than the Malay majority, which controls the government, and which is guaranteed various benefits that are denied to non-Malays. Prejudice is another word that has been distorted beyond recognition in order to sustain a vision. The straightforward meaning of prejudice, prejudgment, is, in an ethnic or racial context, stretched and twisted to mean any adverse opinion about a minority group. This implicitly assumes that any unfavorable judgment about the behavior or performance of any minorities cannot have any factual basis and so can only be explained as being a result of a prejudgment. But when German Jews in America were socially accepted into many elite circles from which all Jews were later barred, after an influx of Eastern European Jews, the origins of these barriers cannot have been anti-Jewish prejudice as such, though the persistence of such barriers long after Eastern European Jews had become acculturated to American society shows the weight of inertia. Similarly, blacks lived in white neighborhoods in many northern cities in the late 19th century, and their children went to racially integrated schools before the massive influx of blacks from the South at the beginning of the 20th century. Can the change to racial segregation in both housing and schools be attributed to prejudice or to experience? To say that it must have been prejudice is itself a prejudgment. Again, inertia would cause these adverse reactions to outlast the circumstances which gave rise to them and to apply to individuals quite different from those whose behavior provoked racial barriers in the first place. Blacks are by no means the only ethnic group whose advancement has been promoted by its own internal transformations, with greater acceptance by the surrounding population being an effect, more so than a cause, of the group's advancement. Acculturated German Jews who had achieved respectability and social acceptance in 19th century America lamented the arrival of masses of Eastern European Jews who were far less acculturated, less educated, and were often poverty-stricken. The German Jews' fear, which proved to be well-founded, was that the arrival of huge numbers of such people, foreign in appearance and repellent in behavior to American society at large, would lead to hostility and barriers against all Jews. This understanding led, among other things, to organized attempts by German Jews to assimilate the Eastern European Jews to American standards of behavior, cleanliness, and lifestyle. This internal transformation of the Jewish population led over the years to lessening hostility and greater acceptance by the American population as a whole. Again, this did not mean that there were no inveterate anti-Semites who would be hostile to Jews in spite of anything that the latter could do. But neither can hostility to Jews, after the arrival of vast numbers from Eastern Europe, be explained as simply an arbitrary prejudice, especially coming after German Jews had already been accepted, even in the higher reaches of society. In the case of immigrants from Ireland, the massive efforts of the Catholic Church in the 19th century to Americanize Irish immigrants are seldom mentioned among the reasons why the "No Irish Need Apply" signs faded away during the 20th century. The picture too often presented might lead one to believe that it was all just a matter of prejudice and bigotry in American society that lead to such signs in the first place, leaving their disappearance in later times unexplained, except by some generality as progress or by the efforts of the enlightened to dispel such prejudices and bigotry. The very possibility that the Irish themselves were different in the 20th century from what they had been in the 19th century is too often passed over in silence. The long social struggle that led to this result virtually disappears from history, as seen by those who make prejudice an all-purpose explanation. This not only deprives these and other minorities of credit for past improvements, more importantly, it deprives others today of a potentially valuable example of ways of improving their own futures. Strained terminology such as prejudice is just one aspect of the power of a vision. A prevailing vision can become the default setting for thought and action. Assertions consistent with the vision can be made without meeting the additional requirement that they be consistent with the facts. Indeed, facts themselves may be viewed suspiciously or subjected to higher standards of proof when they are inconsistent with the vision. Achievements have preconditions, and those preconditions, whether internal to those seeking achievement or external aspects of the surrounding world, would need to be considered. Redefining achievements out of existence avoids all these complications that distract from ideological visions and political agendas. But neither internal nor external preconditions can be ignored if we are serious about history and its integrity as a record that can be relied on when weighing present-day alternatives. The history of groups and whole nations that rose from poverty to prosperity is especially valuable for those who would like to see today's lagging groups advance. But the experiences of such groups are an especially dangerous threat to those with a vision of external causation. Immigrants from Asia to various countries around the world have been prominent among groups that have risen from poverty to prosperity, often in the face of racial discrimination. One of the remarkable things about people from China and India has long been that they have prospered in countries around the world, except in their own homelands. Even with all due allowance for selective migration, the emigrants including more than their share of able and ambitious people, there has still been a striking contrast between the ethnic Chinese economic domination of the economies of a number of Southeast Asian countries and the poverty of the Chinese in China. As late as 1994, the 36 million overseas Chinese produced as much wealth as the billion people living in China itself. Immigrants from India living in the United States averaged higher incomes than the American population. People of Japanese ancestry have likewise had higher incomes than the average American in the United States and higher than the average Canadian in Canada, while in Brazil, they have owned three-quarters as much land as there is in Japan. In all these cases, economic success stories began in poverty. At the beginning of the 20th century, Japanese immigrants to the United States were domestic servants and agricultural field hands to an even greater extent than black Americans. As late as 1920, a majority of all the Chinese living in the United States were either laundry workers or restaurant workers. Most overseas Indians began their careers in the 19th century in East Africa, Fiji, Trinidad, and Guyana as indentured laborers. In more recent times, Korean immigrants to the United States have likewise begun at the bottom and progressed upward into small businesses, and their children into the professions. While some may regard such experiences as inspiring and a heartening example of what can be done to overcome poverty, To those with a vested interest in the prevailing vision in the media and in academic social science, including history, these stories undermine their fundamental beliefs and the general thrust of welfare state government. To the political representatives of other groups that are still lagging behind the general economic and social levels of their societies at large, the success of Asian immigrants is resented. Whether to Maoris in New Zealand or blacks in the United States, Asian immigrant success stories are bitter medicine. The stirring up of animosity and even violence toward Asian bloodsuckers by racial activists is just one consequence of this. At higher intellectual levels, the rise of Asian immigrants from poverty is often glided over in silence when portraying less successful groups as victims of arbitrary barriers based on race, or when depicting external circumstances in general as decisive factors in group advancement. Still less does the success of Asian immigrants support the view that protests and politics are key requirements for raising lagging groups out of poverty. Any reasonably informed American, for example, can far more easily name 5 prominent black leaders than can name even 1 prominent Chinese American or Japanese American leader. The fact that the Chinese have long prospered better outside of China and Indians outside of India undermines the multicultural view that Western prosperity in general is not due to any superior features of Western institutions. The fact that both China and India have had sharp upturns in their economic growth rates after they began transforming their economies in the direction of Western capitalism toward the end of the 20th century provides further evidence against current efforts at promoting a neutral agnosticism about differences among societies. It is not just ethnic minorities whose fates tend to be explained, or explained away, by external circumstances in keeping with the prevailing vision among intellectuals. So have behavior patterns among Southern whites. Cotton has created another culture pattern for the South. The seasonal and cyclical nature of his money not only serves to give the cotton grower a shifting standard of living, but throws him back upon credit and prevents his acquiring habits of thrift. After a season of deprivation and close living on niggardly credit, comes the sale of the crop and cash income to be husbanded, if possible, until the sale of next year's crop. The income of the cotton grower has its peaks of high prices, but these peaks are not planned for, and they do not serve to level up the general standard of living. In the cotton belt, luxuries are likely to be bought on the spur of the moment during a good season in cotton and to be paid for in the poverty of next year's living. One can neither exercise a systematic thrift, budget expenses, nor indulge in installment buying on irregular returns from cotton. This ignores the fact that the ancestors of these people lived in the same spur-of-the-moment way on the other side of the Atlantic, in places where cotton did not grow. But once an external explanation of behavior is available, internal explanations are seldom sought, and weighing the two against one another is rarer still. That is what is meant by saying that the prevailing vision is the default setting for many. Poverty is one of the most widely used external explanations of intergroup differences, but, like other external explanations, it is seldom tested empirically against alternative, internal explanations. Many poorer groups lag in intellectual development, but others do not. As noted in an earlier essay, poor Jewish immigrants in the early 20th century made use of free public libraries in New York, and the books they checked out were primarily serious works, while lighter and more popular books were left gathering dust on the library shelves. Among their ancestors in Eastern Europe a century earlier, even the poorest somehow managed to have books in their homes, while the larger population around them were overwhelmingly illiterate. A similar pattern was found among the people in 18th century Scotland. Even a person of relatively modest means had his own collection of books, and what he couldn't afford, he could get at the local lending library, which by 1750, virtually every town of any size enjoyed. At about the same time, on the other side of the Atlantic, Thomas Jefferson was complaining that there was not a single bookstore in his vicinity, and a century later, Frederick Law Olmsted commented on how seldom he saw books, even in the homes of Southerners who could have afforded them. Still later, in the 20th century, E. Franklin Frazier commented on how seldom even black college faculty read books. Nothing better illustrates the dominance of unsubstantiated dogma over empirical evidence than the pervasive belief that the advancement of economically or socially lagging groups requires a sense of group pride, identity, and self-esteem, and that self-hate must be exterminated as a barrier to such advance. The plausibility of this belief is not in question. What is open to very serious question is whether or not it is supported by any hard evidence. Yet such evidence is seldom asked for or given. Putting aside for the moment the emotionally loaded terms of such discussions, is it in fact the case that groups which exhibit pride and identity advance faster or further than groups which see themselves as inferior in achievements, knowledge, and sophistication to some other groups whose progress they wish to emulate? Ultimately, this is an empirical question and does not depend on anyone's philosophical or ideological orientation, though such orientations may make some more willing or less willing to investigate the empirical evidence. Any serious investigation must begin with an understanding that we cannot see directly into the hearts and minds of other human beings. All that we can see are the outward manifestations. This simple fact must be confronted at the outset, as equally applicable to those who hold one belief rather than another, rather than have it surface at the end when one set of beliefs has failed the empirical tests and seeks escape by saying that we have not discussed real pride or real self-hate as they exist in the recesses of other people's minds. Judging by what we can see and by what history has recorded, what is in fact the track record of breastfeeding versus the cultural cringe? A definitive answer would require an encyclopedic survey of history that would take longer than anyone's lifetime. However, we get along with less than definitive answers to most of life's questions, so this is not an insuperable barrier to learning what we can and reaching tentative conclusions, subject to later revision. Modest as this goal may be, it is better than a blind refusal to look at the facts for fear that they will undermine some cherished beliefs. Two of the most remarkable examples of dramatic advancement by whole peoples have been the Scots in the 18th century and the Japanese in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Both provide evidence on the issue of pride versus self-hate. Scotland. As far back as Roman times, Scotland lagged behind England, and as late as the 14th century, there was said to be no Scottish baron who could write his own name. Scottish agriculture was primitive, and its industry virtually non-existent. The people were illiterate, and there was no law and order, except for the arbitrary edicts of local clan chiefs. The largest city in Scotland in the 17th century, Edinburgh, had a population of just 16,000. Part of the reason for Scotland's lag behind England was geographic isolation. Scotland was on the outer fringes of European civilization. England was closer to continental Europe, which was for centuries more advanced than the British Isles, so that cultural artifacts of a more advanced civilization found their way across the Channel to the English. But whatever the reasons, the Scots lagged behind the English, and were painfully aware of that fact. After centuries of conflict, the English invaded Scotland, first the Lowlands and then the Highlands. They conquered Scotland both militarily and culturally. Scots were conscious to a painful degree of their backwardness, their poverty, their lack of polish, their provinciality. Scots began to speak English, usually with a heavy accent. A society for promoting the reading and speaking of the English language was formed, and lectures on the subject drew hundreds, including James Boswell. Even such an intellectual giant as David Hume took lessons in English pronunciation, and he warned fellow Scots against using peculiarly Scottish expressions, a warning repeated both in his letters and in Scots Magazine. James Mill deliberately purged his speech of Scottish pronunciation and expressions. He moved to England and raised John Stuart Mill and his other children as Englishmen, who never heard him speak of Scotland. Nor was he unique. Demeaning or not, the overwhelming desire to pass as English and to transcend Scottish origins was symbolic of the more pervasive fertilization of Scottish life with external influences. It eventually facilitated the universalization of Scottish scholarship, which was the hallmark of the Enlightenment and the outreach of its own culture. Back in Scotland, Lowland Scots copied the English, and Highland Scots copied the Lowland Scots. Scottish farmers even used an English plow that was completely unsuitable for the soil of Scotland. In short, 18th-century Scots represented a clear example of the cultural cringe. What was the result? First of all, the spread of the English language, beginning in the Scottish lowlands, opened a whole new world of literature in numerous fields to the Scots, fields in which there was little or no literature in the indigenous Gaelic language. Education caught on so widely in the Scottish lowlands that they had compulsory education before England did, and developed the most extensive system of schools in Europe. Not only an educated class, but an intellectual class developed in Scotland. As a distinguished historian put it, "In every branch of knowledge, this once poor and ignorant people produced original and successful thinkers." From the middle of the 18th century to the middle of the 19th century, most of the leading British intellectual figures were either from Scotland or of Scottish ancestry. These included David Hume in philosophy, Adam Smith in economics, Joseph Black in chemistry, Robert Adam in architecture, James Watt in engineering, Sir Walter Scott in literature, and John Stuart Mill in economics, philosophy, and political science. In medicine, Scots likewise moved to the forefront, not only in Britain, but also in Russia, where Catherine the Great had a Scottish physician, and in America, where Scots established some of the earliest medical schools. Scots also set the world standard in engineering in general and shipbuilding in particular. By 1871, nearly half the ships built in Great Britain were built in Scotland. Scottish universities surged ahead of English universities in science and engineering. In short, the Scots eventually surpassed those from whom they had once learned. Japan. The isolation which has often kept some societies lagging far behind others was a self-imposed isolation for Japan. From 1638 to 1868, emigration from Japan was forbidden on pain of death, and foreigners and foreign trade and foreign cultures were kept out. In short, Japan was one of the most self-insulated countries in history, and was also very poor and backward. This era ended dramatically when American warships under the command of Commodore Matthew Perry entered Japanese waters in 1854 and demanded that Japan open its ports to the outside world. Helpless in the face of such overwhelming modern force, Japan had no choice but to submit to this demand. It was a turning point in the country's history. This painful demonstration of Japan's weakness and backwardness before its own people and before the world set in motion internal reforms and an agenda for national development that dominated the country's history for the next century. Japan's leaders in that era held up the West in general, and the United States in particular, as examples to be emulated. Western technology was imported, and Japanese students were sent to study in the West. The English language began to be taught in Japanese schools, and there was even a suggestion at one point that English be made the national language of Japan. Textbooks issued by the Japanese government held up Abraham Lincoln and Benjamin Franklin as models for the young to imitate, even more so than Japanese heroes. There were euphoric descriptions of the United States as an earthly paradise. It would be hard to find a more striking example of the cultural cringe than 19th century Japan. An episode shortly after Americans forced Japan to open up to the outside world illustrates the situation at that time. Commodore Perry presented a train as a gift, and the Americans proceeded to demonstrate it. At first, the Japanese watched the train fearfully from a safe distance, and when the engine began to move, they uttered cries of astonishment and drew in their breath. Before long, they were inspecting it closely, stroking it, and riding on it. And they kept this up throughout the day. No one could have predicted then that, a century later, Japan would produce its own bullet train that surpassed anything available in the United States. But it happened only because the Japanese recognized their own initial backwardness and were determined to overcome it. They began by learning all that they could from the West and emulating the West until they reached the point when they had amassed the knowledge, skill, and experience to take their own independent direction. In the first half of the 20th century, Japanese products were widely known as cheap, inferior imitations of European or American products. Even after Japan later began to produce higher quality products, such as cameras, the first Canon was an imitation of the German Leica, and the first Nikon was an imitation of its German rival, the Contax. Over time, however, these and other Japanese cameras evolved into the leading cameras in the world, both technologically and in terms of sales. Similarly spectacular developments occurred when the Japanese entered the electronics, automotive, and other fields. Black Americans. Against the background of the history of Scotland and Japan, today's assumptions about the effects of pride and self-hate as factors in progress are hard to sustain. Against the history of blacks in the United States, many other assumptions are equally hard to sustain. The history of the black population of the United States might be summed up in broad outlines as follows. Sold into slavery by African leaders, at a time when slavery was widely accepted in all civilizations, blacks entered a particular segment of American society and culture at the bottom, acquiring only the rudiments of Western civilization, not including literacy in most cases, and a way of life influenced by a peculiar redneck culture. Freed after the Civil War, but poverty-stricken, illiterate, unskilled, and unacculturated to the demanding way of life in a free republic with a market economy, blacks began their history as a free people at the bottom of American society. One sign of their lack of preparation for life as a free people was a rate of mortality among blacks in the aftermath of emancipation that was greater than it had been under slavery. This was just one sign of a more general lag in adjusting to the norms of the society around them. The small enclaves of New England culture transplanted among blacks via Oberlin College and Dunbar High School, as well as in black colleges established in the South by New Englanders, did not promote pride in the existing black redneck culture. On the contrary, the clear message in these enclaves was that the way most blacks talked, the way they behaved, and the whole set of redneck values they inherited were all wrong and were things to be overcome. The wholly disproportionate number of black leaders and high achievers who came out of these small enclaves is further evidence in the case of pride versus self-hate. Among both blacks and white liberals, there were those who thought that cultural changes among blacks were unnecessary, that there could be progress without internal cultural change, effects without causes. In the post-1960s world, such views gained the ascendancy, and those who held these views often wondered why it was so hard to raise ghetto blacks out of poverty and social disintegration. Their answer was usually a call for more welfare state programs, more pride and self-esteem, more steeping in the history of black achievement or white injustice. The actual track record of this approach, compared to the opposite approach in the New England enclaves, received virtually no attention. Fortunately, in the decades before this mindset became fixed, most blacks had become better educated and had lifted themselves out of poverty at a rate higher than that after the Civil Rights Revolution of the 1960s. For example, more blacks rose into professional and other higher-level occupations in the years preceding the Civil Rights Act of 1964 than in the years following its enactment. This factual history served no one's political agenda and has since been replaced by a fictional history that does. The economic advancement of blacks has been widely portrayed as due to the civil rights movement and to political leaders, black and white, who have proclaimed themselves champions of black Americans. Since no one has as large a vested interest in opposing this view as its proponents have in perpetuating it, the politically more convenient view has prevailed, along with attributing the continuing economic and social gaps between blacks and whites to the sins and shortcomings of the latter. Nothing is easier to find than sins and shortcomings among human beings, regardless of their race. The question is, how much of a causal factor these moral failings have been in history, and to what extent have they been effects rather than causes? For example, the decline in whites' hostility and discrimination toward blacks in northern cities during the 19th century, followed by a resurgence of hostility at the turn of the century, were not just inexplicable swings of the pendulum in white public opinion. The masses of blacks arriving in the North at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century were denounced in the black newspapers of the time for their crudeness, violence, and crime. It was not just a question of perceptions or stereotypes among whites, though undoubtedly some whites reacted in ways wholly unjustified by the situation, as elements of other racial groups do. Contemporary preoccupation with the evils of society distorts the history of many groups, passing over internal improvements that took decades or generations of effort, because those improvements, whether modest or dramatic, imply that there was something that needed to be improved within these groups, that not all their problems were due to the perceptions or stereotypes of others. Clinging to a counterproductive culture in the name of group pride, and avoiding changes because they could be labeled self-hate, are patterns that have no track record that would justify optimism. The evidence is all on the other side. But that matters only to those who value evidence over ideology, history over visions. Cosmic justice and injustice. Few things are more common or more painful than sharp contrasts between the prosperity of some racial or ethnic groups and the poverty of others in the same society. At one time, such things were accepted as either divinely ordained or as being a consequence of innate racial characteristics. However, as both these explanations were discarded over time, a new notion arose, that these economic contrasts were consequences of injustices visited upon minorities by majorities. Yet that explanation is not without its own serious problems, as great as the problems of earlier explanations that did not stand the test of time. One of the strongest arguments against the injustice explanation of intergroup differences is that, in many countries around the world, minorities with virtually no political power or other means of discriminating against the majority population have nevertheless been far more successful economically, educationally, or otherwise than those who constitute the bulk of the nation's people. This has long been true of the Chinese in Malaysia, Indonesia, and the Philippines, Germans in Russia and Brazil, Jews in Eastern Europe and the United States, Lebanese in West Africa, Scots in North America and Australia, and the Japanese in Brazil, Canada, the United States, and Peru. Clearly, in these and other cases, the minority has simply outperformed the majority population.